You're listening to the Punk News Podcast, episode 341. No. What episode is it?
343.
343?
343.
John, I've been in a vortex.
How come? What happened?
A vortex, John! A vortex! A vortex! Okay, hey, we're back. This is the Punk News Podcast. My name is Adam White. Joining me on tonight's show, we have Mr. John Gentile.
You know, that vortex wasn't nearly as fun as I thought it was going to be, man.
And no, it was just full old furniture.
I know. I was expecting, like, you know, hot Venusian women, hot Martian women, you know, flying motorcycles. It was just old, what do you call them things? Bureaus, you know?
I mean, you'd hope at least if you were in a vortex, there would be an orb of some kind, right?
No orbs, just old furniture and must. It was the vortex of must.
Fucking vortexes these days aren't like they were. Ricky!
Yo!
Ricky Frankel, how are you?
How's it going, guys?
I'm pretty good.
You had a good week.
I've had a week of happenstance, I guess.
Happenstance?
So, yeah, that's a pretty good way to phrase it. Are we talking about that first? I guess we're talking about that first, eh?
Let's get into it.
Wow, we probably should. So, the long story short is that I saw Against Me play a house show, which is not something that happens a lot these days.
What?
Yeah, the long story version of it sort of goes like this. So there is I got an email a few days ago from my good friend Melanie Kay, who is a publicist of the Stars, a person that deals with a lot of the rock bands that come in through Toronto, at least the ones that I care about and that I've done work with on Punk News for like over a decade now. Anyways, so Mel emails me and she goes, "Do you want to go see Against Me play in George Strombolopoulos' house?" And So I'll qualify who George is in a sec, but this was one of these things where, like, it's in 3 days and you need to tell me now. And usually I have to fight the very Adam urge to do nothing because it's easier. But I was just like, I'm like, yes. I'm like, I don't even know what I have scheduled that day, but yeah, sign me up. I'm in, whatever. Let's go. And then I sort of rearranged my life around it. Which is really that's my new ethos, by the way. If I'm rearranging my life around rock and roll, then I am doing something right. If I'm rearranging rock and roll around my life, then I'm on the opposite side, and I don't want that to be happening. So you're
like, a rocker now.
Yeah, I figure I have to, you know, shirk all responsibility and traipse off in the middle of the night to go see bands and stuff. So I did just that. I shirked all responsibility and got on a train and went to Toronto. So this show was at the home of a guy named George Strombolopoulos, which we're going to call Strombo for the rest of the show because everyone else does, and his name has 17 letters in it.
Is he George, Greek? Is that a Greek name?
Yeah, I believe it is. So George is, and this is going to be like a very Canadian kind of thing, I guess, but we're not a country that has a big celebrity culture in it for no other reason than anyone that becomes a star of any recognition ends up going to Hollywood and participating in that, going to Hollywood, going to New York and, you know, participating in these giant, US cultural, industries. And to be a person of name in a Canadian cultural industry exclusively means that, well, really, like, you're doing one or two things. Either you're really purposefully trying to do that, and you're trying to participate in a lot of CanCon type events and and productions and things like that, or you happen to do a lot of work with the few big television stations that are up here, which is what really was Strombo's case. So when I was a kid, George Strombolopoulos was the punk guy on Much Music, on our MTV equivalent up here. And he had a show for a while called The Punk Show. And before that, he at one point was a co-host of a show called The Wedge. And I remember being I was a young kid listening to ska punk. And I remember I wrote an email or called into The Wedge at one point, and I was like, play Less Than Jake. I want to see someone play Less Than Jake. And they played the video for, I think, All My Best Friends Are Metalheads. And right before that, they were like, and we're going to play this new video from that band Blink-182, who you may remember, and they played What's My Age Again. This was right before anyone gave a shit about that record, so it was still being played in the middle of the night at 12 o'clock, because no one cared who Blink-182 was. They hadn't, broken through just right then, so that was just a weird anecdote. But anyways, George was the host of the punk show when I was a kid. When I was in university, actually, at one point, George, who I've now learned from my wife and female friends, everyone had a crush on for a while, he called my apartment, and he was like, he left some sort of message that was like, hey, Adam, you wrote about the punk show, which was the name of his punk show, on punknews.org, man, thanks a lot, or something. It was just super gracious. And then, but I wasn't there, so the machine picked it up. And then my roommates decided that the fact that we have this, apparently super hot celebrity leaving us a message on our answering machine, we can't delete it. So for a good year, that was the message. So anyone who called, you'd have to skip over George to get to the real thing. So he's always been a cultural presence for me. After he finished with Much, he went over to the CBC and he had a big interview show that he did there. And then he at one point became the host of Hockey Night in Canada, which is, as far as Canada goes, that's really the top piece of television that you want to be on. Is you want to be the guy that's, on Hockey Night in Canada, because that's all anyone ever cares about. Now, he was brought in as part of some sort of we're going to try to rebrand Hockey Night, so we're going to bring in a bad boy instead of one of these old guys, and he's going to, he's going to have earrings and a black t-shirt, and he's going to talk about hockey, and he's not going to be the same old guy in a suit that we've had forever. And that didn't really go over that well, but hey, anyways. So Strombo's been around forever. He now has a show on CBC Radio 2 and elsewhere on the internet called The Strombo Show, in which he has a lot of bands come in and play and talk to him, and he plays all a really cool eclectic amount of music. So Strombo was a big deal for me. So not only was this against me playing a house show, but it was against me playing a house show and it was Strombo's house. It made the whole thing there was two levels of import here. And that's really why I wanted to qualify at the start of this, because there's being excited about seeing against me in a teeny tiny space, and there's me being excited about it being in that setting. And that's, I think, a super important distinction to make here, because I don't want to at all try to imply that this was akin to against me showing up in Philly and playing some punk house basement. Like, this was not that. This was not full of, it wasn't all the street punks had the underground, communication knowledge with each other, yeah, that we all had to show up here and make sure the cops didn't show or anything. No. I showed up at a celebrity's house and my name was on a list, and then they let me into the gate.
How big was the house?
That was the one thing that reverses the story here, is that the house is tiny. It's super tiny. It's wedged in between two other buildings. I looked up the house once I figured out the address, and it's one of these houses that it's not a inexpensive place given that Toronto's real estate and everything, but at some point it had I know nothing of the architecture world, but some big Japanese designer came in and was like, "Oh, we have this tiny little useless wedge house. We're going to design a really cool space out of it." So it's one of these odd duck little showpiece places, but you would never know it's there because it's just behind an old gate, a bunch of trees, and there's a house. So I mean, it's way smaller than my house, right? It's super super narrow and small. So I show up I give this person my name. I walk into the yard, not really knowing what to expect. There's a little front yard in front of this house, and it's packed full of people. And they're like, there's beer and sandwiches. And I'm like, all right. And there's just buckets of beer everywhere. And then I started noticing that there was this really bizarre, surreal to me, like, who's who of Canadian music people milling around in this yard with me. So there was one that I actually knew really well because he was the guy that used to book all the shows here in the St. Catharines, Niagara area. Shout out to Timmer. He runs a record label called Indoor Shoes, and he works for MRG Concerts up in Toronto right now. So he books all kinds of stuff. So I saw him and I was like, oh, hey, there's a person I know. Then I noticed Ben Rispin, the guy that books all of the shows in Hamilton, Ontario. He's played in St. Alvia and a bunch of other bands like that. And then I'm looking around and I've noticed that like there's Wade McNeil. Wade is that was the guitar player in Alexis on Fire. He's the singer for Gallows right now. He has a he's one of the main rock DJs on 102.1 The Edge, which is a radio station in Toronto. I look over at a wall across from me and I see Mr. Warren Kinsella sitting on the wall. Warren's a guy I bring up on this show every once in a while. He's the guy that has been, I guess, affectionately called the James Carville of Canada. He ran the war room for the Liberal government when our prime minister in the late 90s, early 2000s got in for three terms. Like, he was the guy that was running that campaign, right? But he was an old punker from back in the day. He still has, you know, he still plays today, but he happens to be a big city, high priced lawyer that makes politics happen, right? So, like, there's this crazy mix of like, I don't want to say insiders, but like insiders, right? Like industry people and, you know, people that had known someone who knew someone that was in the music industry, and me, and I guess I'm one of those people. So we're all standing around pounding back as many beers as we can before we are allowed into George's house. And then he kind of comes out in the porch and he's like, all right, like, first of all, you know, this is crazy. We always do shows here, but we never do this. Like, we'll always have bands come in and play, you know, acoustic or solo or something and record them for one of his radio programs. He does not have like a 4-piece band play a properly set up rock show in his living room. So he's like, we don't exactly know how we're going to fit all these people in here, but we're going to try to fit all these people in here. So we all just started smushing towards the door and we got pushed into the house, and I ended up standing like against his kitchen island next to the sink, basically looking at the band. And it was one of these houses where, like, there was like a kitchen living room thing that were connected. So the band was all set up at the other end of the living room. And it was, but then from that point in, we're in this dude's house. It was his house. Like, it wasn't, I was a little bit skeptical that it was going to be some sort of like cleverly named art space or something.
Yeah.
But like, no, like, you know, his fucking box of cereal was on the shelf. Like, it was a used house, right? Like, the dude did live there. So Against Me is there and played a pretty amazing set in a teeny tiny room. And it was absolutely filmed by, like, there was like 5 or 6 cameras floating around in everyone's face. By the time the footage of this comes out, I'm going to be all over it, I'm sure, because you couldn't not be if you were in the room and they warned us all. There's like a disclaimer stuck on the door. Like, we're filming the shit out of this. So if you even walk in this house, you're involved. Right. Take away all the Adam Canadian cultural junk that leads up to it, and it was Against Me playing in a small house, which was amazing. So that, you know, that was my yesterday, I guess. Was that yesterday? I don't know.
What did they play, and how long was their set?
I tried to scratch this out. I think I've got a bunch of it now, because of the whole setup for this. Like, it was sort of like an early in, early out thing. Like, the show started like not too long after like 6:30, and we were out by 8, right? Like, it was like this was there for, like, you know, we're gonna film this thing for use. It's not there so you could like be there until 1 a.m. drinking beer at the bar. So it was done really early. So, and it might have even been shorter than usual, but I couldn't really tell because I was just fucking high on life. Not on drugs, life. And so
Oh, I thought you said high on drugs, not life. But he's
no, life. This was the pure. Well, three of Strombo's beers that I pounded back, and life. So this is. I scratched it down because I knew you were going to ask, Ricky. So best I can remember, Pints of Guinness, nice. Reinventing Axl Rose, Teenage Anarchist, Baby I'm an Anarchist, Miami, Rebecca, Crash, True Trans Soul Rebel. I think Transgender Dysphoria Blues, but I might be wrong on that one. The Ocean, Unconditional Love, a cover of The Mountain Goats' Best Ever Death Metal Band out of Denton.
Uh-huh.
And they closed with Black Me Out. Now, there was probably other songs that were in there, but those aren't sticking in my head at the moment, but those ones are. So that might be a set list. That might be too short. I don't know. But anyways, that was...
That's still fucking cool.
That, oh my God. Yeah, it was super fucking cool. It was the band played like a real show. It wasn't, you know, despite, you know, the fact that there were cameras floating around and some of the, and that, you know, it was full of all these like, I guess like music industry assholes like me that didn't deserve to be there. Like the crowd was into it and everyone was singing along and they played without, you know, they didn't stop to acknowledge like the artifice of anything. It wasn't like, oh, this is weird and just being done for TV. It's like, no, we're going to play this show actually here in Strombo's house. And, you know, there is, in my mind, at least, like, you know, his minor Canadian celebrity aside, George is a person to me that carries a lot of weight from an authenticity standpoint, because like, God, like for a whole generation of people, like he introduced them to bands like Against Me in this area. So, you know, I got nothing but love for the guy. So, it was all levels of surreal and craziness to me.
I just real quick. I know who he is. I used to watch, people used to upload his show on YouTube, The Hour.
Yeah, The Hour was his interview show that he had for a while on CBC.
And then he did, and I guess now he has the Strombo show, but he's a really good interviewer and he has really great guests that are much more interesting than anything you'll get like on like Stephen Colbert or Jimmy Fallon here.
Oh yeah, and really like the problem with so much of Strombo's career is that they always looked at him and said like, okay, this is an incredibly charismatic guy that has like some edge to him.
Yeah.
So we're going to throw as much real world at him as we can, and inevitably it will stick because everyone loves him. So when he was doing like Much Music, of course, it, like he was right in his element. And then when he was doing The Hour, those of us that I think followed him over from Much, we really liked what he was doing there. But I don't know like how much it played in the general public to the same degree. And then He actually had a show, like a summer show on CNN for like seven episodes or something like that, called like George Strombolopoulos Tonight or Strombolopoulos Tonight or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. And it was the same sort of calculation where like everyone in Canada loves this guy, let's make him in the US, right? And just either it just wasn't the right format or something, but just it just didn't click. But like he's one of those guys that to me like I don't know, like I liken him a lot to say like Anthony Bourdain, say, where like people know who he is. He's, you know, depending on if you pay attention to that scene, a celebrity, but you get the impression that he's doing this because he's like genuinely interested in it, not because he's looking for, I don't know, not because he's trying to like be a celebrity. So him doing like the Strombo show stuff now totally fits, because it's back, like right in his sweet spot with the stuff that he was doing on Much Music. So that's, yeah. So I don't know. So yeah, that was pretty, I don't know. Should I like give like my thank you list? I feel like I won an award. Like thanks to Mel and to Strombo.
Jesus.
Thank Jesus. I guess I should thank Laura because she played the show. I don't know. Like it was really cool. It was weird. It was one of those, I don't know, like thing you do punk news for a long time and every once in a while you get a weird opportunity like this that pops up and then you go, oh, this is why I do this. So yeah.
Well, listen, when Crass throws a house, when Rudimentary Peni throws a house show in Philadelphia,
I like that you changed it because you stumbled on the name.
When Rudimentary Peni plays a Philadelphia house show, I'll be waiting for my invite. Now we know what the price is, and the price is an awesome house show. So,
mm-hmm. That's the reward. So you punked news away for like 16 years, and then you get a cool you get a cool show. But then you go back to the real world, and no one likes you again. That's how it works. Anyways, so yeah, Ricky, I did this thing. So
I'm jealous. What do you want from me? That's fucking awesome.
I kept thinking about you. I'm like, for some reason, I'm like, man, Ricky, be jealous of this. I don't know why. Well, everyone loves against me, so I don't know why I picked you out, but I picked you out. And I'm like, this is a Ricky thing.
Well, I appreciate it, because that is a Ricky thing, and I would have, I mean, goddamn, that would have been awesome.
Yeah, so that ends the part where Adam boasts about his life on the show. What do we do from here?
Where do we go from that? Well, listen, we're talking about awesome things. Last week, we spent an entire week talking about an awesome thing. Black Flag Week was last week. We covered literally every single officially released Black Flag track and one unofficially released album. I personally was getting hate all week long in the comments section. That doesn't mean anything. But then at the end of the week, everyone said how much they liked it. You know what I mean? So the question was, did you guys enjoy Black Flag Week? Did you think it was a success? And should we keep doing the band weeks? Do people enjoy that? Or is it for every one person that enjoys it, 15 people are annoyed? From my own perspective, I actually think Black Flag Week might have been our, I don't want to say best week, but our most professionally done week, in that we had a feature every day with interesting content, with unique content, and we covered every single record, which we haven't done in a band week before.
You know, I like these weeks, I think, but I don't think doing more than two a year is necessary, and I think it would get old fast. But I like this, you know, what, like beginning of the year, end of the year kind of thing. Overall, I liked Ramones Week more, but I still thought this was great.
Honestly, I was disappointed in the reception to that. People were complaining about Black Flag Week. I'm like, you realize this is punknews.org. Yeah. Punknews.org. I feel as though the punk rockers, I feel that a lot of people say they like punk, but they really like pop music and they just like the punk affectations. It doesn't get much punker than Black Flag.
Yeah.
I could be wrong. It's just my perception. Both internally and externally, I don't feel the enthusiasm was quite there as it was for Clash Week and Black Flag Week. And I think it's because Black Flag is harder. Maybe I'm wrong. But to me, Black Flag is perfect for a week because there's several different eras. Each era is unique and the band is punk as hell in any era, even if not every era is great. Necessarily.
See, yeah, I agree. I think we're just looking at the comments, but I mean, like, you know, I actually was sort of nervous about writing about What The, because I thought, like, oh fuck, it's just gonna be a disaster in the in the comment section for that one. But it was just petty bullshit, and if anything, I learned more because I wasn't like, you know, like you probably heard on the Black Flag podcast, I had to be careful because I'm not like as well versed in them as you are. I mean, I've listened to them for years, but still I just kind of listened to them and not really gone into the history that like a ton. I overall, it was definitely a success. Nothing went horribly wrong or anything like that.
But do you think we did the band justice? Did we do the band as well as we could have?
John, I think when you showed me that Keith Morris liked that post of yours when you were sharing Black Flag Week, I think that said everything.
Do you think he liked that? Just so the listeners know, is I showed the staff, Keith Morris clicked that he liked my review of Live in 84. Do you think he clicked that he liked that because the first sentence was essentially, too bad we never got a Keith Morris record, live record, that's frustrating? Or do you think he liked it because I gave due deference to the later era of the band, instead of just slagging them and saying it's not as good as Damaged?
Why not both?
Could be. Adam White?
Maybe just felt honored that we were doing Black Flag Week to begin with.
Could be.
Well, of course, me and Keith Morris have a psychic connection, so I can tell what's going on.
Oh, really?
Internally, in his head, yeah. He's just hungry right now. He's not thinking about it. So, sorry, that's all I'm getting. He's hungry. I don't know. I mean, let's assess these kind of weeks. I think that so long as we don't do it, so long as we don't do them so close together that it becomes an annoyance for people.
Yeah, I agree with
then
that.
Then I'm perfectly fine with them. I mean, we're an entertainment news website, so it's not like we can't devote a chunk of time to doing something that isn't necessarily timely. And it's not like we have important things that we ever need to talk about. Like, we can do a Black Flag Week and at the same time talk about, you know, the fact that, you know, Off With Their Heads is going on tour with XYZ or something like that. Like, we can do both those stories at the same time and not be avoiding anything. We're not, you know, we're not CNN. It doesn't matter to us that there's a, you know, Supreme Court nominee going through a hearing. We're like, we don't need to go, oh shit, what are we doing? We can't devote time to Black Flag Week. We have important breaking things to devote our efforts to. So I'm perfectly fine with it from a, you know, from a something that's getting our attention standpoint. What I think is just that it just suffers from the general group of commenters, John, that have decided they hate you.
Yeah.
and by suffer, I mean, no one in the real world gives a shit, but of course you're going to look at the comments and it's going to bug you.
I think to
the vast majority of readers, it's either something that they were going to enjoy or ignore. And that's like anything else.
I never learn. I'm always like, wow, this is a neat article. No one's ever done a significant review of the 82 demos before. No one's ever done a retrospective of all the post-Black Flag bands. This is interesting. What will people take from this? What will people add to it? And I get so excited. I'm like, wow, what are people going to say? And I scroll down. They're like, we hate you. Black Flag Week sucks. You know what I mean? It's like, why don't I ever learn, Adam? Why don't I ever learn?
John, I think I have picked out the core of the, I think something beeped up here. I picked out the core of people's annoyance with you, and I've decided that it's nothing anyone can do anything about, and they just have to go pound salt. So what that core is, John, is I've decided that you are a maximalist in that you live at the, like, if you had to choose between, you know, are we going to do this subtly and, you know, on the sly and tastefully work it into the existing order of things, or are we going to fucking drive this like a truck through the wall and woo, right? You're going to veer towards the, let's drive this like a truck through the wall. Like, let's do this 1,000%. Let's, in the words of a band that isn't Black Flag, like, let's go for all. Right. Mm. So you go for all. And I think for anyone who is legitimately going for all, you can't not be sort of loud and excited about it. And if you're a person who is on the internet judging things, that's really like the antithesis of what you want to enjoy, because if you're a person that's on the internet judging things, your preferred form of media is I think people that are also approaching things with this sort of like snarky, cynical, you know, whatever, man, kind of sense, right? And anyone that's not doing that, anyone that is like just sincerely trying to just fucking do it 1,000%, that's not the kind of thing that rubs those people the right way. So your whole vibe, John, is it just angers up the kind of people that would angrily comment on punk news. There's nothing you can do about it. It's just like an opposite ends of the magnet.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm fine with that. I just got to learn to just not read the comments at all, even if I'm hoping there will be interesting discussion. And I don't even mean praise. I just mean interesting discussion. But there never is. There never is. Anyways, well, Adam, I think I agree with your assessment, and let's look at some other people's assessments. You can always reach us at podcast@punknews.org. This is from Miguel. Miguel says, please read this on the air. That is all. Thank you, Miguel. So that's from Miguel.
It's the best letter we've ever gotten.
This is from Joe. This one's pretty funny. Joe says, "In the and actually, this is talking about Black Flag Week. And if people listen to the Black Flag Week podcast, Tom Trauma and I got in a heated argument. My stance was, actually, it was me versus these three knuckleheads. But it was my stance was flag is not nostalgia. Flag is three.
No, I was on your side on that one.
I don't. Well, I'll have to go back and check. I'll have to go back and check the tape.
I was totally against the whole nostalgia thing.
Okay.
Go back and listen.
Then it was me and Ricky versus the world. Just like Double Dragon. Imagine an 8-bit picture. Ricky and we both have our fists up and we're back to back. And there's all these like ninjas around us. That's me and Ricky. Double Dragon style. Me and Ricky were arguing that Flag was awesome and was not nostalgia and was a reckoning and guys showing why they are the best at doing what they do. And Tom, and to a lesser degree, Adam, who was leading some support, was that it was nostalgia and that it was basically just a bunch of old guys playing great music, but maybe there's not a whole lot of artistic merit to it. Adam White, is my assessment about correct?
No, not really. I mean, no one was sure. Yeah, you know what? Fuck it. I'm just going to own it. Yeah, well, that was what I said.
Well, anyway, me and Tom Trauma got in a rumble over it, and so this is what Joe had to say. In the aftermath of the difference of opinion and the unrepairable rift that I'm sure was sure to follow between John and Tom, I was wondering if you guys were breaking up. If you are, I had to go with Team Tom, or as I like to call it, the trauma unit. Not because I agree with him. I don't. I live in St. Ignace, Michigan, and he's in Grand Rapids. I believe all people from Michigan should stand unified regardless of whether or not they think Flag is a tribute band. That was the argument. Adam was saying it was a Tom and Adam were saying it was a tribute band. Also, John will probably get the Canadian, and that is something I can't support. One question remains, though. Where does Little Ricky fall? I call him Lil because every time he talks, I picture Beaver Cleaver with a hipster beard. If Lil Ricky ends up with Tom, they both seem to listen to different styles of music. So one would never have an opinion on what the other was talking about. That could keep the kids from being subjected to the anger and animosity that exploded during the Black Flag special. I ran out of shit to say, so the reason I wrote this is I wanted to say great work to you guys on the Black Flag special. I enjoyed it a lot. Anyways, that's it. You guys keep talking and I might keep listening. From Joe. P.S. Adam, since you're Canadian, I need a favor. I don't ever want to hear Rush or anybody talk about Rush ever again. I don't know who you have to petition to get that done. Just have them do it. Just have them do whatever they did with Alanis Morissette. That would be great.
Well, I resent the Little Ricky part.
I think he means out of love, but Little Ricky's not so little anymore. Little Ricky's like 26, I think, right?
I'm 25.
Yeah. I think you got about one more year worth of Little Ricky, and then I think you just regular Ricky.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. You know what? This is YYZ from Moving Pictures, 1981. Fuck you. No, I'm not actually doing that. That's not play the song. Continue.
He asked my opinion on Flag versus being a nostalgia act or not. Was that it?
No, he didn't ask your opinion. It was just, Ricky, it's called comedy. He was saying, is the Punk News podcast getting divorced because of the Rumble? And if so, will you be granted custody of Tom and will Adam be granted custody of me? Will I be granted custody of Adam?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I missed that. Okay.
It's yes. Jokes, Ricky.
The answer is yes. Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Adam, play a song. To play some Rush, would you?
Can I play some Rush? Oh, God. All right. You know what? Just for that, I will play as much the opposite of a Rush song as I can scrape up. So if I'm put in charge of things and I'm allowed to, like, sub out the Rush for some non-Rush Canadian stuff, then maybe this will work. So this is the, I'm pretty sure they are from Sackville, New Brunswick. This is the band Astral Gunk. And Astral Gunk is like a crazy psychedelic garage punk band. They record, you know, as far as I can tell, they record everything live. They release everything on tape. They release shit in mono. They don't care. They sound horrible and it's great. So this is a song that was recorded live off the floor at Hamtrak. I think it was called Hamtrak. but it was recorded in Michigan. So this is important for our whole discussion. So this goes out to Mr. Tom Trauma and Mr. Letter Writer,
Joe.
Letter Writer Jones. Oh, Joe. Okay. Hold on. What is this city called? How do you pronounce this city, Michigan?
Oh, where he's from? St. Ignace.
No. The city that this was recorded in. So it is Ham Tram CK. Like the Hamtramck.
Oh, good old Hamtramck City. I love Hamtramck City.
Hamtramck. It's like a fucking Klingon word. Like there should be more vowels in there. Anyways, this is from there. This was recorded there in 2003, so, or 2013. So there you go. The song is called Scrotum City, and the band is Astral Gunk, and it is totally not a Rush song. So here you go.
Scrotum City. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Anyways, that was Astral Gunk. I still can't pronounce that city. Please, someone send us an audio recording of how you say the name of that city.
Next time Tom's on.
Oh, fuck, yeah. All right, we're going to ask Tom next week. Okay, no one send us audio. We don't want it. Record Store Day. They've announced the list of exclusives that are going to be available on the 2017 Record Store Day, which takes place on April 22nd. It includes stuff from... John, you wrote this article because...
I did not.
Nope.
Did you
I
not?
I did.
Oh, look. Okay, so John just infected your mind because I'm looking at the list of bands, and the list of bands, I'm assuming in priority order goes Hawkwind, then Motorhead, The Offspring, Iggy Pop, Ramones, Tegan and Sarah, Sex Pistols, Integrity, MDC, Nothington, All Against Me. All those bands are involved in this shit.
I did write that list, didn't I?
You must have, right? It's prioritized. So there's a full list over at the recordstore.com website that lists all the shit that they've got coming out. I was scrubbing through the list, so I got a couple things that maybe are interesting to me, but I'm not sure. I think there's one of them that is, I want to say, almost story worthy from like a punk news standpoint. But we'll get to that in a sec. Anything on here that jumped out to you guys?
Yeah, man, I'll tell you, they keep reeling me back in. Every time I think I'm done Record Store Day, they keep reeling me back in until I get there and I see they won $37 for a one-track 10-inch single, and then I'm disgusted again. But there's actually a lot of cool stuff here that I really want. First of all, we talked about it a couple of weeks ago. I want both David Bowie releases. I want the David Bowie live album and the David Bowie Bo promo disc. I want the Ben Folds live record, which looks really cool. I actually don't want the Hawkwind stuff because it's just expensive reissues of stuff that I already like. I can't understand the point of spending $35 on a record that you can get an original press of for $10 or less. I can't understand that, and I think that's where Record Store Day is continuing to fail. They just keep putting out records that anybody can get anywhere. However, I do think those records sell, so maybe it's a purely economic decision. That there's a couple other I don't want the Iggy Pop thing because that's just going to be super expensive. And you can get that on CD for cheap, even though it probably is a cool thing. One of the good things about a Record Store Day is it does allow them to put out stuff that would not be able to get put out otherwise because the demand isn't high enough. They're putting out a Runaways record of their earliest recordings, which has never been released, which will be really, really cool. They're putting out the Smiths 7-inch, which will be really cool. And I think there was something else. But like I said, the Tegan and Sara record. This is the ideal purpose of Record Store Day. Tegan and Sara's first record, which honestly is not that great of a record, has been long out of print and is a very, very expensive record. So they're, and actually it's a CD. It was never a record. So they're finally putting it back out as a record instead of a CD. I don't care one way or another what format it is, but at least there's a physical version and I'm excited to get it. And this is exactly what Record Store Day is for, to get obscure, weird, and out of print stuff back in the press. That so fans can enjoy it and treasure it. And so I'm very excited.
Okay, so as to how this this article is written, I just wanted to see if anyone would notice if I put Hawkwind first, and it worked.
Ricky, have you ever listened to Hawkwind?
I don't believe I have.
You should listen to Hawkwind, Rick. Everyone should listen to Hawkwind.
I'll listen to Hawkwind after I finish my next another Cro-Mags album, too.
You only need to listen to one Cro-Mag. There's only one Cro-Mag album worth listening to.
Okay. For me, every year, believe it or not, there's only like a few things that I usually want. Last year, I think was an exception where I got like four or five things. This time, I have like two things. I kind of like I'm like my must want list, and then one on my maybe if I can get it. I would like the Against Me 7-inch. It's a picture disc with two new songs on it, so that's like my number one. And then AJJ, which I think you said that, Adam.
Ricky, Ricky, you are younger. I'm going to ask you a question. Do you know what that AJJ record is a reference to, or is it's an homage to? I think most people don't even know what that's an homage to.
Honestly, I thought Decade of Regression sounded like it was a play on something, but also that is such a, they are so self-loathing sometimes that I just didn't put it past them to just make that
it's
up.
A Slayer's live album, Decade of Aggression.
Okay, that makes sense.
A seminal live heavy metal thrash, it's probably the most famous live thrash metal record there is, and it's extremely important because it was released when Slayer was at their absolute height. So I think Against Me is being pretty, because Against Me is not a heavy band. They're very, I like AJJ. They're not a heavy band, but I like AJJ. But they're kind of making fun of themselves and that they're not Slayer. You know what I mean?
Well, they're not totally making fun of themselves here because they actually cover Slayer.
On this release?
I don't think on this release, but the last time I saw them, they played, I think their last song was, a Slayer cover.
See, I can never get a gauge on this guy because, you know, they changed the name from Andrew Jackson Jihad to AJJ because they didn't want to hurt anybody's feelings. But then he's covering Slayer. So I don't know how you can like love Slayer that much, but then be that, I don't know, sensitive?
I don't know. What was the song? It was
South of Heaven. He put out like a skateboard comp and he covered South of Heaven. I know that.
Yeah, they played South of Heaven when I saw them too. Then the other thing, and I'm not sure where I'm at with this because I it looks cool, but there's that Ramones 7-inch box set, which I have a feeling will be expensive.
I advise against that. I mean, it's just repressed. I mean, it's not even like they're analog represses. They take digital tracks and put them in a 7-inch vinyl and charge you $70. What's the point?
If you had to, stock a jukebox, like that would be decent, right?
But you could buy the OGs for cheaper. You know what I mean?
Can you?
Yeah. Ramon 7-inches are pretty cheap because there's so many of them.
I'm not sure where I'm at on that one. I'm gonna have to think about it. But overall, I think that's it for me. I mean, what was the sex? Then there's the shit. Okay, and I pointed a couple out. They are literally selling a double LP of. Hang on a second. Where is it? I want to make sure I get it right. Shit, hang on a second. Oh, okay, the Space Jam soundtrack?
Yeah.
And then also, and this one was even somehow they managed to find something even more objectionable to put out, and that's Corey Feldman 7-inch featuring Snoop Dogg.
Oh, see, I'm all for that. See, I think that's great. I think that's a whimsical, interesting, funny thing. I think Record Store is perfect for that. The Space Jam soundtrack. Who wants that? You know what I mean?
I don't know. I think it's... I laughed at both out loud.
So there are two things on here that I'm excited about from a really cynical standpoint, in that I'm excited to get them from the bargain bin 2 months after Record Store Day. So the one is that for whatever reason... Rhino is pressing an LP of Coral Fang by the Distillers. Now, I love that. I love that album. I think it's great. I do not have it on record. I want it on record. I don't need it on record so much to spend a whole ton of money on it and wait in the line and everything like that. But it seems like the kind of thing that enough people would not care about that I'll be able to get it out of a, when they're trying to get rid of all the Record Store Day stock after a while. And I mean, sort of like same, I'm looking at like this, they're doing a vinyl pressing of, Greg Graffin's record from 10 years ago again, which I liked, it'd be cool to have it on vinyl, but again, I'm not going to wait in a line or anything. So yeah, hopefully I can find those two later on. I'm not against line, mind you. Like, I'm kind of excited to go down and wait in a line just because there's usually cool stuff going on in the record store that day. At least the SRC Vinyl in town here. Last year they had like a little backyard garage sale kind of thing that they attached to their whole Record Store Day event, and lots of little giveaways and things, and like it was fun. So I sort of, I'll probably go, but do I need either of those two things? Not desperately. And they're not interesting. I mean, they're not crazy exclusive releases or anything like that. They're just, just things that probably should have been on vinyl at some point, which doesn't sound like it's very much in the spirit of, releasing weird shit only for collectors. Now, in terms of weird shit though, this one I think is worth discussing. Did you see there's something on the list there called Recutting the Crap?
No, I saw White Man at Hammersmith Palace.
So Recutting the Crap is a record that is on this list. Now, various artists thing. It's a compilation. I have no idea who any of the bands are on it, looking at the list here. But just the concept here is pretty neat to me. So it says, in 1984-85, The Clash toured the U.S. and Europe to showcase several new songs. The tour was a tremendous success, and people were very receptive and excited about the band's stripped-down sound for their new songs. The upcoming album was to be titled Out of Control, so most fans were shocked to hear when it was renamed Cut the Crap, which was released in the fall of 85. Most of the album was unfinished, with scratch vocals and mixes by the band's manager. Over the years, many a Clash fan have always wished the album was properly redone and remixed. So finally... I like how they say, so finally, everything has led up to this release, but that doesn't quite compute with history. But anyways, so finally, in 2017, it is finally being revisited by diehard Clash fans. They have recorded and contributed their versions of the songs from Cut the Crap, as well as some songs that were from the Out of Control demo sessions. This is volume 1. Volume 2 will have more songs and da 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 that's being released later this year. So anyway, so it's a release of this, a bunch of Clash fans in bands putting together a...
I don't see this anywhere. Is this under various artists?
Yeah, it's... I don't know. It's on the list. It might be in the regional releases section, but it's called Recutting the Crap. It's got like a big, you know, military star like the Clash would have used in red. And yeah, I mean, I beats me who any of these bands are looking at the list. So, which is not to say anything negative against them. I just don't have any comment here, but you know, a bunch of people got together and said, what if we tried to make Out of Control as it should have been made? And they are putting this out. So this is either going to be neat or it's going to be one of those weird bootleg thingies.
Got Don Zietar on it from Bad Brains and Fugazi producer. That's kind of cool.
Oh, see, you can pick someone out of the list then. Yeah. So I don't know. I know nothing about this, but it piqued my interest.
This see, to me, this is what Retro Day is all about. Like, weird, interesting projects, you know?
Mm-hmm. Ooh, you know what you can also get? Aqua made a 7-inch of Barbie Girl, and it's a pink 7-inch.
I'm like, let's have a serious discussion about the Clash, and you're like, not enough.
Because half the fun of looking at this list is seeing what, like, just pure garbage they're putting
out. But people sometimes buy into the hype, you know, like literally buy into the hype. They're like, I can't wait to get Aqua Barbie Girl. I just really like that song. It's like, you like it so much that you want to spend $16 for it? You know, they're like, yes. You know, I was like, ugh.
Oh, yeah. I think I might get the Nothington 7-inch too. We'll see. I don't know.
So anyways, that's been the consumerism portion of the show. I guess we'll move on and talk about a few things here. No consumerism here, only the most epic and blackest of metals, also bats and tits. So I wish Tom was on this episode for this reason. No.
Oh, nice.
I wish he was here with us, Ricky, not in place of you, but with us, because
bats.
All right, so Danzig, John, tell people.
Danzig, well, he has given more details about his new album. It looks like it's definitely going to be out in May. I think second to last Friday in May. The album is going to be called Black Laden Crown, but very late era Danzig style name. I dig the name. The cover is not great. It's got kind of, I would say, maybe a Viking kind of looking woman, but she's got like a bat sitting on top of her breasts. And she's covered in blood. And I don't know why the bat's sitting on top of her breasts. Oh, and she's got like two fire globes in her hand. And it's very, very comic bookish. Well, I mean, it's a drawing. It's not a picture. But it's very, very, very comic bookish looking. And I don't love this cover. Danzig is very hit or miss with his covers. You know, Danzig 1 and 3 are some of the most iconic imagery of all time. The first one featuring just the classic Danzig logo, and the third featuring the H.R. Giger picture, which is an amazing image. Danzig also, as history has shown, is a master of imagery and branding. I mean, the Misfits logo is probably the most copied logo of all time. Maybe Black Flag beats him, but not. But the Misfits font, which he still uses in Danzig, more or less in a modified form, the Misfits font is probably the most copied band font ever. I mean, how many bands have used the Misfits font? And not to mention how many bands have copied the Misfits style, you know, Ghouls and Goblins and all that kind of stuff. But man, like this cover is just cheesy, and I think it undermines the seriousness of the music. And you could say, oh, well, Danzig doesn't really care about, like, the music is kind of supposed to be silly or cheesecake. But then when you hear him talk about it and when you hear him play it, he's dead serious. You know what I mean? Like, he's not doing the Cramps thing. He's not doing the Necromantics kid and play thing where everything's like tongue in cheek. When Danzig is singing about Satan and the end of the world, and like, he's serious. So why he would put this cheesy, corny picture on the cover baffles me a little bit. It doesn't baffle me that I know he likes hot girls and I know he likes anime and comic books. So he just kind of combines all of them and it's something he likes. I just wish that the picture was a bit more fitting than, you know, a comic book type image that is relatively uninspired, to tell you the truth. That being said, I think the album is going to be great. His last full-length album, Death Rad Sabbath, was his best in over 10 years. It was his best in over almost over 20 years. Wait, his best in 20 years. No, yeah, almost 20 years. Yeah. His last album was his best album in almost 20 years. So, no, I'm sorry, almost like 15 years. So this one, I think, will be very good. It might even be great. It's just the cover, just, man, not. Luckily, Danzig's albums don't really have too much correlation with how good their cover is. This cover is not great. I'm sorry, Danzig. I'm a huge fan, but this cover is corny.
Yeah. I don't need, I don't know.
What's going on with this picture, Ricky? What's going on here?
I don't know. It's, you know, I'm trying to figure out if it has anything to do with the title of the album, and it just doesn't. And God, it just, it's, it, I don't know.
It looks like something a 14 year old would think was cool.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, did a nephew of his like draw this and think it was funny or what? I don't know.
He does these weird things with breasts and like his anime is wrong. Like she's got like eyes on her breasts, which is weird. And like on the cover of Circle of Snakes, he had a Medusa, and the Medusa had snakes' heads coming out of the breasts, which just seems very weird and creepy to
me. I think and didn't on his last, he had some, on the last album he put out, he had some other girl on there.
The last one wasn't as bad because it was painted, so it looked more real, I guess, it looked less comic bookish. But the image was just kind of the dumb image. It was like a hot woman with a skull's face holding a candelabra. Like, it was just, that's just kind of a dumb image. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like, you know,
it is, yeah, it's just, you know, it's not that I have a problem with the image itself. It's just, it's drawn weird. Like, it's like, I don't know. Is it trying to appeal to like the underground meme culture of like 4chan? I don't know.
Is there, how old are you now that you said the underground meme culture of 4chan? Yeah. Like you were like a 50-year-old news anchor trying to sound like they were talking about the internet.
What else am I supposed to, how, what else are you,
I don't know,
but dark shit on that website. Like, this is, I don't know. This is sort of a caricature, John.
Is this what all these perverts are doing on their Reddits these days? Oh, God.
You kids and your Green Dave and your Jeff Leppard.
Anyways, yeah. So, Danzig, there's still no music from this that anyone's heard, correct?
Correct.
Correct. Okay. We're just moving down like the John Gentile cast of characters here. So, Morrissey is next on the list. You want to explain this? Or you want to comment? What's your?
I'll explain it, and then I'll let you guys give your take, and then I will come back with my hot take.
Which, you got a hot take?
I do have a hot take that no one seemed to hit, and I think just like Morrissey said,
don't give your hot take.
I'm not going to give my hot take. Okay. I'm saying I think Morrissey and I have a just like Adam and Keith Morris have a mental psychic connection. I think me and Morrissey have a psychic connection. Because I reviewed the Philadelphia show, and he said it was the best show of the tour. And people are getting very mad about this, but I think I know what Morrissey's actually doing. Anyways, on his current tour, Morrissey's putting out a shirt. The shirt has the text, "I wear black on the outside, cause black is how I feel on the inside," which is a Smiths lyric. But on the cover of the shirt is a picture of writer and African-American activist James Baldwin. And to escalate things, on James Baldwin's shoulder on the shirt is Morrissey, and it sort of looked like James Morrison is purposely wearing a Morrissey shirt. But of course, that couldn't be because this picture is from like 70 years ago, 60 years ago. So Morrissey put his own name on James Baldwin's shirt. James Baldwin's picture is on the shirt, but James Baldwin's name is not on the shirt. And people got really upset about this for about 2 hours. And they said Morrissey was racist. And then as the internet is, everyone forgot about it because, well, multiple reasons. Anyways, people are upset. Adam White, were people right to be upset and call Morrissey a racist because of this shirt?
Ah, fuck. I don't know. I mean, it's, I don't know if Morrissey was being racist. I think Morrissey was probably in his own combative way. He was, I think I know exactly what happened, is that you know, we know that Morrissey is a fan of James Baldwin. We know that Morrissey is a fan of thumbing his nose at what the rest of the world thinks sometimes. So he sat down, the concept of the shirt was put together. He looked at it and he said, yeah, you know what? It all works for me as Morrissey, because as Morrissey, I can see that James Baldwin is wearing a black shirt. I can see that he has this thoughtful look on his face that works with my lyric. So fuck you, it works. And then, you know, everyone around anyone in a normal situation would say, yeah, but you know how people are going to read that, don't you, Moz? Like they're going to look and they're going to say, well, you have a black gentleman on the shirt and you say I wear black, and that's what people are going to put together, and it's going to be misconstrued. So maybe you should not do that. But I don't think Morrissey has those voices in his life telling him not to do something. Slash, I would also think that Morrissey would look at those voices and give them some sort of like British fuck you and do what he wants anyways. And that's probably what's going on here. So I don't think he was trying to be racist or offensive. I think he was probably very aware that it could be construed that way. I just think that he is stubborn enough to do it anyways.
Yeah,
that's my read.
I think he's
trolling. A troll. See, there you go.
Yeah, I think he's trolling.
Just like the 4chan kid.
You know, I don't even know about this. I don't know when it comes to the shirt, but here's the thing. Here's what I'm noticing about this guy, Morrissey. It seems like he needs to cause controversy in order to stay relevant, to make sure he knows he's still relevant, and he's going to be relevant for a long time. But, you know, he causes trouble for publicity. He did it right before when the Misfits were announced their reunion at Riot Fest. Then he said, oh, I'm not playing Riot Fest. Then he played Riot Fest. I think this is just the winter version of that. Mm. You know, we need another Morrissey up in arms thing. He probably saw it and said, perfect. Everyone on the internet, on Twitter, is going to freak out about this. And, we'll have it selling on tour. And people will buy it, and people will buy more tickets. So yeah, still thinking the worst of Morrissey.
I enjoy Ricky's proposition that Morrissey continues his relevance by causing drama and controversy.
Yes,
much like Paris Hilton. That's interesting. I never thought of that, but I'm willing to entertain that. Here's what I think it's more. Of course, Morrissey knows this is going to make people angry. Morrissey enjoys making people angry. Morrissey enjoys causing frustration, anger, and just negative vibes on people that he perceives to be not as intelligent or not as artistic as he is. And I think that's what he's doing here. And to me, here's my artistic read of this shirt. If we look at it, James Baldwin is wearing a black shirt. The lyric is, I wear black on the outside because black is how I feel on the inside. And everyone's like, Morrissey, how dare you compare yourself to the struggles of a black person? And I think Morrissey's response would be, well, how come when you see this, you see a black person first and not a guy in a black shirt that dealt with mental health issues, which is a big part of James Baldwin's au revoir, if you will. And so I think Morrissey is saying, no, I'm not the racist because I'm seeing him as a full person. You're the racist because you see him only as a black person. You didn't even notice that he's wearing a black shirt.
That's exactly what he's doing. But the problem, I guess, with the rest of the world.
Well, how come nobody mentioned that? Like, nobody mentioned that online.
Well, I'm sure that was his intent. But the problem is that, like, in a way, that's him going, like, so, yeah, who's the real racist now?
That is him,
right?
Like a carpet.
It's him doing that. But the problem is that out here in the real world, you sometimes have to decide if you making a snide point about something is worth a multitude of people immediately misconstruing what you're doing. Like, it seems very much like he didn't pick a battle here that a lot of people could get on board with.
Well, right? Yeah.
I get why, like, let's say you're a band and you have a song that can be easily misconstrued, but
guilty of being white.
Guilty of being white, right? That was exactly what I was going to say, right? So you have your guilty of being whites. You have your white riots, right? You have these songs that, like, on the most surface level, can be completely misconstrued.
But there's
a pretty solid message behind what you're going to do. And as soon as people start to look a little bit deeper into it, that message comes to the fore, and then you've communicated something with people. You know, by provoking a little bit, but you've communicated something serious with people. This, where it's just a fucking t-shirt that was in his store. It seems like the most inane thing to create that level of battle about. So I think that's more what's baffling, I guess, me and I think a lot of people in the world, is that, like, why is that the hill you want to die on? Right? Like, it would be one thing if this was, say, the cover to his next record, because then he could, you know, he could roar into battle and defend it and make his point and explain why everyone else is the real monster. And he'd be justified in doing it, because he could say that, like, okay, no, this was the artistic statement I was trying to make, and I'm more than ready to get in and fight that battle. But it was just like a t-shirt that showed up in his online store. And at that point, I don't know, I'm wondering why whoever in Morrissey's circle didn't stop and go, like, are we gonna get in a fight about this? Well, because is this the thing that we're gonna get in a big fight about right now? Because it seems so unimportant.
Two counterattacks, though, Adam. First of all, I think Morrissey has no one in that circle, because I think anybody that would voice that has either been beaten into submission or removed from that circle. You see, I'm not gonna name names, but there's a couple of punk rockers that have, and I liked them a great deal, but very much have that group of people around them. Second, everyone was crying about this for 2 hours, and then I literally haven't heard anything about this since the day it was news. So why would Morrissey get upset? Like, he knows that, like, people, that outrage is fleeting, because many people are just want to outrage and they don't really care about the underlying issue. So why should Morrissey get shooken up over something that literally petered out 2 hours later? Literally 2 hours later.
The follow-up to this is that the shirt has been removed. It was removed yesterday from his store, so it's no longer for sale. But it wasn't like it was removed with a, you know, they didn't get a parade or anything. They just took it down.
Those shirts weren't even printed, guaranteed.
No, the people bought them on the tour dates. That's where they were mostly sold.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Wait, then why didn't free people freak out about it during the tour?
Oh, because it was simultaneous, almost.
Oh, I didn't realize he was on tour now.
He did a couple of shows, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, then, conspiracy theory taken back.
you never hear conspiracy theories. Conspiracy theory guys like, I was wrong.
I rescind it.
I had one last thing. Oh, I do think Morrissey lives by one of my favorite Buzz Osborne quotes, which I think is a good quote to live by, but not 100%. Never admit you're wrong if you're not wrong. Buzz Osborne.
I hate how we talk about Morrissey as if he's some like some Plato or like Shakespeare. And we have to like really delve deep into what and like decode what he's thinking and what he's doing.
You have to admit, Ricky, that there is a clever ambiguity to a lot of his work, which is what makes him interesting. You got to agree with that.
I guess I just don't like him as a human.
But see, that's part of the Morrissey trap.
I'm fully aware of that. Yeah, I get that. I get that totally.
I'm willing to give him this, and this is not making an excuse for Morrissey, and his lack of battle picking judgment. Today, with most artists, everyone's all social media'd as much as they can be. So if this controversy happened to, God, I don't know, Chris Farren, right?
Yeah.
he'd have 300 conversations about it with people on Twitter and whatever else until the issue is exhausted. I mean, And that's not, and Chris is maybe a bad example because he would have 300 Twitter conversations with someone about something else anyways. But
yeah, Chris ran up 300 Twitter conversations about like a sandwich. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So let's say it happened to
AJJ.
Right. There would be a big prolonged discussion about it online. There would be lots of interviews and talking about it and this and that. And bands are so accessible these days that like, the mystique fades away to a degree where you're in it with all the rest of us. And at some point you're going to get called out about it and have to defend yourself. Morrissey still exists on like a level that was around in I guess like the 80s where, you know, he's not going to come out here, into the pig shit with us and argue about these things. He's going to go do the things that he does and then reemerge and do the things that he does and then reemerge and do the things that he does. And if they cause controversy, you know, he's going to engage with it when he chooses to engage with it, but he's not going to sit around and like blow away his mystique by, you know, doing a 25 part tweet storm about it, or, you know, 300 interviews, or, you know, telling us what he's having for lunch the next day, right? Like he's one of those few artists that is maintaining that level of detachment that doesn't really exist these days. And I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing, but I guess it's a good thing for Morrissey. I don't know if that's a good thing for artists in general, but in Morrissey's case, it means that we can still have these kinds of conversations about him because he's just not accessible on the same level as everyone else has chosen to make themselves. Does that make any sense?
I think Morrissey, marketing wise, makes himself exactly as accessible as he should marketing wise. That if he was more accessible, the mystique would be lost and people would be less interested in him. If he was less accessible, people would forget about him. So he very carefully chooses how and when he will enter the public perception, public audience.
Yeah, I don't necessarily want to say that people should do that because there's a virtue to, you know, all of us being in it together and all of us kind of sharing this conversation and tearing down some of the walls that used to make people rock stars and other people fans, right? Like that's a good thing in most cases. Morrissey existed before that universe.
But how weird though is he came out of the punk rock scene. You know what I mean?
Well, sure he did, but you could be from the punk rock scene and still be pretty inaccessible and enigmatic because of the media at the time, right?
True. I retract my conspiracy theory.
Yeah, like you could totally do that. You know what I really think is the right way to describe this, John, is that you're aware of someone else with the stature and ego of Morrissey, and his name was Galactus, Devourer of Worlds.
Ah, yes, my favorite Marvel supervillain.
Right. So Galactus, if you're up to speed on your Galactusness, he was not always Galactus. He was I want to say a human, but a human like alien whose name was Galen, and Galen lived in the universe prior to this one. And then when that universe was destroyed, he was like the sole survivor of that universe. And then sort of on the other end of the Big Bang that created this universe, he emerged, changed, and he had become Galactus, the World Devourer. But there is still much of him that calls back to that prior, now destroyed universe. And in the same way, Morrissey, John, is a relic of the past that has become a world-destroying genocide monster.
Indeed, and
is it not?
He does have the power cosmic, that's for sure.
And he does. He has heralds. Why don't someone play a song so I can stop talking about comic books? And then we'll go on.
Oh, thank God. So there's an album that. That didn't get enough. I felt like didn't get enough attention, and I went back to it you know, last week, and I'm like, oh god, this is good. This is maybe should have made it onto my end of the year list. But it didn't get a lot of attention on the org. I don't know how much press they did either. Usually I'm pretty up on the on Fat Record bands. So I'm gonna play a song from Useless ID's album State is Burning that came out last year on Fat Records. And it's really good. The whole album's really good, especially if you like that kind of, you know, the it's like a more updated, edgier, like Epiphat 90s era kind of thing. But they kind of put their own twists on it, and it's really an interesting album. So the song I'm going to play is called Stopwatch, from Useless ID's State is Burning. Here it is. By the way, I meant thank God because I just was glad we were done talking about Morrissey.
Oh, no, it's going to sound funny one way or the other.
Behold the power cosmic.
Oh, Galactus, you're so powerful.
Behold the power cosmic. I devour worlds. No, Galactus, don't eat Earth. We're too nice. I don't care. Do you greet the cockroaches on your floor? No, Galactus, don't kill us. Galactus, I challenge you to a duel.
John, be careful. Greg might leave this in.
Be hilarious.
Editor's note? Oh, I left it in, John. And now, back to the show.
I challenge you to a duel, Galactus. I'll crush you, mortal. Like, but a duel of quizzes. Oh, Duke, go on. Galactus, can you answer this riddle? When is a jar not a jar?
Whoever's listening to this, and if Greg left this in, please don't unsubscribe.
When is it door, not a door? I don't know, Reed Richards. When is it jar? Damn, Reed Richards, you got me. I will now not destroy the Earth, and I will fly away. Thanks, Galactus. You're okay in my book. I know you destroyed billions of races, but, you know, as long as you don't eat Earth, what do I care? That's true. Now I will fly away with my herald. The Silver Surfer.
I don't know what just happened. All right, we're back.
I narrated the Galactus battle with Reed Richards.
Oh, for Ricky's benefit?
Who's
Ricky,
benefit?
Are you up to speed on your Galactus? Is he gone?
I think he got too scared.
Ricky left and you were just narrating.
Oh, no, I'm here.
Oh,
I'm
here. Okay.
I'm here.
All right, hold on. Here we go. Boop, 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 boop. 4, 3, 2. Okay, we're back on the Punk News Podcast. We got a few more stories that we're going to talk about before we wrap up this week. First off, Weezer is a new song. It's called Feels Like Summer. It's horrible.
It's really terrible.
my summer's ruined.
No, I was listening to this. I got through 30 seconds and I'm thinking, you know, I've never been a Weezer fan, but I could always tolerate their music. I don't know how any Weezer fan can stand by this.
Yeah, so I mean, what's the actual story details here? Are there story details? There aren't. There's a record that's coming out this year. It'll be called Feels Like Summer. That's all that we know. They are going on tour. They are on tour. Never mind. Sorry. Playing a bunch of dates in Canada right now. Headed down into the States. Lots of music festivals. They have stuff scheduled actually through October. They're going out to Europe later in the fall. So, anyways, Weezer is doing a record, touring. That's totally great. Their last
is it
record,
though?
I mean, hey, no, I'm saying good for them. The last thing that they released was, I think, the White Album. Was that the last record that they had that came out?
I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah. So they had a record that came out called the White Album that a lot of people I know that are Weezer fans appreciated outside of. I've heard they appreciated it outside of the radio single that was from it that I don't recall at the moment, but. Well, one of the issues with Weezer in their current incarnation is that they keep appearing that they are trying to chase some non-existent teenage fandom that's out there. So they release these singles that are dumb. That are, I don't know. I mean, you remember that, what was it? Like Beverly Hills, or is that song? Like,
yep.
Like they release singles that like, frankly feel beneath them. Like they're so much better songwriters and they have written so many much more affecting stuff. And then they release these dumb singles that are just like the worst kind of schlock. And I don't know what they're trying to shoot for because it's absolutely not what anyone that was a holdover fan from like 1994 wants. Like none of us that grew up on the Blue Album or on Pinkerton, when they finally came back, because they were, I don't know if they were officially broken up or they were just on some sort of extended hiatus, but like they vanished for like a decade, right? When they finally came back with the Green Album, a lot of people were expecting some return to this mythical band that we had all built up in their absence. They were one of the bands that really benefited from internet fandom very early on, in that there was, while Weezer was inactive, an incredibly active early like message board based music community that was built around them. Really in the early days of punk news, one of the things that like totally dwarfed us in size was the fan community on the Weezer website. And this was in like the early 2000s. And like, this didn't exist anywhere else. And it was just immense. People trading B-sides and picking apart what's going on in River's Head in this song or that song. And, it was sort of a beauty to behold the devotion that this band had based on two records. And then they came back and they've just been releasing stuff like ad nauseum since then. And so much of it leads off with like a big goofy radio single that I don't know, like that in a universe where that mattered much anymore, I guess would be another shot at getting a number one or something. But anyways, I don't know who it's for. And I guess that's what drives me. That's what I don't get. I don't know who it's for. This is, Is my read on this incorrect, that it is completely auto-tuned, like aggressively auto-tuned?
I got that. There are a lot of there are a lot of instruments I was not used to hear that were played that I'm not used to hearing in a Weezer song.
Or like and, in a rock band at all. I mean,
I don't know.
It is an incredibly produced piece of studio pop music, and not in a good way. It fulfills like every generic stereotype that one would have about like vapid auto-tuned modern day pop. And
I mean
that's the only thing that I can imagine, is that they did it on purpose. And I mean, of course they did it on purpose because they created the damn thing. But yeah. I don't know who it's for. Not for me.
My question is, is this stage fright? And they're like, there's no way we'll ever do. I'm not even a Weezer fan, but let's assume for this conversation I'm a Weezer fan that thinks the first two albums are great. Is this stage fright where they're like, we'll never be as good as we were on the first two albums, so let's just do random wacky shit, and that way we never really try, and people think we're just kind of being goofy or funny or daring. Or maybe this is them just being uber punks and being like, screw you, we're not going to give you what you want. We're just going to do random, wacky, stupid shit just to piss people off. Could it be that?
I don't know, because like you imagine that if you were going to go do random wacky stupid shit, you would be more aggressively weird about it.
True.
Like they're not being Frank Zappa, or like they just keep leading these records with these completely like out of character, especially considering what else is on the record, singles that, I mean, they got to play to someone, but they just make me cringe. I just don't get it. I don't get it. I'm less angry about this being bad because I'm way past the point of caring what this band does, but I'm just bewildered that you could be a serious Weezer fan and then have a record like this come out and want to do something with it. I don't get it.
There is something, I guess, interesting, you will, in that when a band, it's not that they make difficult records that you might not like, but they're difficult and challenging. They just seem to be purposely making bad records. You know, it's not even as if they're making mediocre records where they're not trying. They appear to be trying to make bad records, you know?
Maybe they're trying to get out of a label contract.
I think we just,
I don't know, that. They've got like 12 of them or something. Like there's...
They keep signing bad contracts. We did it again, boys.
I have no read on this. I have no insight. I mean, I could totally make that kind of argument if we were talking about the second or third record after they came back from the dead. But this is shit. How many are there? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. This is their 11th record, right? So I don't know, man. I give up. I don't know what they're doing here, but I don't like this song. Boo. That's my read. Boo, says Adam White of punknews.org. That's what I want on the sticker. Oh God. All right. Warped Tour.
You want me to read this one?
Read this one.
All right. So, it's not up yet today's Wednesday, but this will definitely be up tomorrow. Today the Vans Warped Tour announced via Facebook Live its 2017 lineup, and there are some surprisingly good bands on here that I think people that listen to this podcast would actually give a shit about. So we can delve into, I can list off what I sifted through throughout the list. If you want to see the other bands, you can find the link directly to the whole lineup on the Vans Warped Tour website. But playing it this year are some bands that played it 20 years ago, which was kind of interesting. So playing it is Anti-Flag, TSOL, The Adolescents, Big D and the Kids Table, War on Women, Strung Out, Street Dogs, Guar, Riverboat Gamblers, Municipal Waste, Suicide Machines, Sick of It All, The Ataris, The Dickies, Barbed Wire Dolls, Microwave, Bad Cop, Goldfinger, Streetlight Manifesto, Bowling for Soup, Valiant Thor, and a lot more. The festival will start in June, in Pomona, California, in early August. So, and again, you can find the link to the whole lineup on the Punk News article. What happened? Usually we never care about this, and suddenly there are bands that we do care about that are on this lineup.
There's bands among the nonsense, I guess.
But this is like the first time where there's like a good amount, where like usually we'd find like two that we could talk about. This time,
yeah, I'm looking at the list, like I'm somewhat surprised to see like War and Women on here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just because they've always seemed like a band that would just on principle not play something like this. So that's kind of interesting to me. I don't know. Maybe they realized that like there's no more young kids and everyone's just getting older.
It's interesting.
Like, do the 16-year-olds of today listen to and participate in rock music, or do they just like use their,
do they just watch PewDiePie on YouTube?
PewDiePie and their, yeah. What do they do well, there well, with their, I mean, their, I mean, but Microsoft Wii's and everything.
But I mean, they're also going to have, I mean, these are bands that, and this is probably why I won't go. I've never been to Warped Tour. I don't think I'll make it to this one. But they're playing amongst bands like Bless the Fall and probably like Black Veiled Brides in a Mirror. God, it's so, I feel like these bands just clash with each other to some extent.
Well, good on, what's Warped Tour's name? What's his name?
Kevin Lyman.
Good on him for bringing some content back to the thing. And also, yeah, man, I'm all about variety, you know? I mean, if it takes, you know, slipping in a TSOL or Bad Cop, Bad Cop or Guar or even a Municipal Waste to slip them in between Black Veil Brides and I Prevail and these other terrible, terrible bands. If you guys slip them in, get them interested and get them. And I don't mean to be a music elitist, but if you guys watch bands like Attila, After the Fall, it's not only is it bad music, not only is it offensive, in my opinion, it is possibly damaging to young people. And so if that's what it takes to slip in some bands with some intelligence, even Bad Cop, Bad Cop, you know, Bad Cop, Bad Cop is not an overly serious band. However, they do slip serious messages and very thoughtful and thought-provoking messages underneath their perhaps more sunny exterior. So sure, if that's what it takes to get interested in perhaps more intellectual or at least more honest and more less marketed music, I say good on it. And I say let it roll, baby, let it roll. I also think Kevin Lyman might be feeling kind of like maybe he's kind of like – He's given it a spin. For the past 10 years, he's been taking nonstop shit from, you know, the music industry fans, critics. And so he's like, well, all right, let's give it a shot. Maybe we can make some money with some good bands. And if we can, let's give it a shot. So,
well, see, that's what I thought the whole It's Not Dead Fest thing was about, too. I mean, if you last time, I mean, it was like all the a bunch of the bands that played that 2 years ago now. A lot of them played Warped Tour, but he made it a separate festival here. I think it's good though that one that they're doing It's Not Dead Fest 2 this summer, but also I think I agree. I think that maybe mixing it up and bringing in a slightly older audience, obviously an older audience and a different audience to see, you know, these bands would be a good thing all over the country, not just here out here in Southern California.
I agree that it will bring in an older audience, but I hope his goal, aside from making money, is that he's trying to educate younger people, if you will. I hope.
I can see that.
Am I taking too much of a rose-colored glasses to Guar? Guar is, of course, a very, very interesting, very intellectual band, but they are not. They really are. Especially if you read the lyrics, especially if you see the costumes and see the topics that they address and the way that they address them. However, that is not that apparent at just a cursory reading, if you will. So maybe I'm being too rose-colored. I don't know.
I don't know. I'm not sure. I've had a long time of being too old for Warped Tour.
I've been too old for Warped Tour for almost 20 years.
I know. So, and I'm looking at this list and like, yeah, there's things where I could see myself wanting to go see, and there's things that I could see wanting myself to run away from.
Yeah.
Right. I give them credit though for coming up with a mix that is somewhat interesting, at least to our old universe. It's funny though, because if you go look at the comments on the Alternative Press article that they ran about this today, it's full of people saying like, this lineup sucks. Like, what the where's all the bands? So, you know, different strokes, I guess. So anyways, Warped Tour. We have one last story this week that we want to talk about. I'm giving it some dramatic pause here. So the original, Mr. Chuck Berry, has passed away. Everyone should know this because it's been all over the news by the time anyone's heard this, and it was rightfully so all over the news. So, rock and roll legend, rock and roll pioneer, Chuck Berry, he passed away at the age of 90. No cause of death had been announced at the time we ran the article, but hey,
being
he
freaking
90,
old,
right?
Being freaking old.
And
he was still active.
Yeah, so I don't know. I don't know how much we need to personally say about Chuck Berry outside of the fact that he helped create a genre that we talk about week on week on week. So, credit to him there. do we need to go into a detailed bit here, or do we just want to play some music?
I just want to say one thing. I mean, he was Johnny B. Goode was one of the first songs I learned, like, that was moderately difficult on guitar. So, and it his music, if you're starting to learn guitar or even bass, it's, and you want to learn like anything harder than that, or maybe metal or whatever, it all begin. They all start with him. Like it, and yeah, it, I don't think his influence has been really measurable, and I think he's one of the few people to do that. So no, we lost a great. Yeah.
Mr. John, any thoughts on Mr. Berry, or are you going to play something?
What can you say with someone as legendary as Chuck Berry? For a while, I was thinking, well, maybe his influence is overstated. But then when you look at the rock and roll guys before him, they don't really play guitar like Chuck. I'm a huge Elvis fan. Elvis didn't play guitar. Well, actually, Elvis did play guitar. But the players in Elvis's band, they didn't play like Chuck Berry. You look at Ike Turner, Rock of 88. That's considered a rock tune. But they're not playing like Chuck Berry, but everybody after Chuck Berry does play like Chuck Berry. So you could fairly say Chuck Berry invented rock and roll. It's the name of that. Let's just play the classic. I mean, you know, we usually try to avoid the classics on Punk just because everyone's heard them. But if there was ever a more fitting time to play the classic, I've not heard it. Let's play the classic Johnny B. Goode, one of the greatest rock and roll songs ever, possibly the greatest. Johnny B. Goode by Chuck Berry.
At the end of the Punk News podcast for this week, if anyone wants to send us any mail, podcast@punknews.org is how you do that. Thanks to Mr. Greg Simpson for producing and putting together this show week on week. Any other stuff we got to talk about? Anyone we got to thank? Thank you, Mr. Jack Kirby, for coming up with Galactus and allowing me to explain Morrissey. I don't know. Anything else? We good? We out? That's it.